Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a new proposal seeks to provide a conservation-minded alternative to the controversial $1.8 billion Lake Powell pipeline. Members of the Indigenous-led organization Utah Dene Bakaya asked to assist in a federal review of Native American boarding schools, and how Utah athletes are faring at the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Joining me in studio for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. Brian, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's so nice to be back in the studio after more than a year, Roger.
Welcome back, and great to have you here. We've also got Tribune San Juan County reporter and Report for America Corps member Zach Podmore. Welcome, Zach. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for having me in today.
Of course. And later on the show, we'll hear from Olympics and Enterprise reporter Julie Jags, so stay tuned for that as well. And you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or tweet to @KCPW. We'll pay attention to Twitter to see if there are any comments that come in that way. Brian Maffley, let's start with this report or this proposal that you reported on. It's billed by its proponents as a viable or, you know, preferable alternative to the to a very controversial project, the Lake Powell Pipeline. Where is this proposal coming from, and what is it?
Yeah, the groups behind it are American Rivers and Western Resource Advocates, and what they're proposing is they are building this case, as are a lot of other groups, that Washington County, which is the fastest growing part of the state, if not the country, can take care of its water needs through a combination of better managing its local water sources, mostly the Virgin River, and get serious with reducing per capita water use.
Yeah. And so there's water, basically, there's water available locally that isn't being used. And also, if you conserve more, the need for the Lake Powell pipeline goes down. What about the amount of growth that's happening down there, though?
Well, that's just it. The St. George area is projected to triple in population by 2075, you know, which is still 50 years off. But, you know, from like 170,000 to almost 600,000, that's a lot of people. And the conservation community is pretty frustrated that the state of Utah is going to heavily subsidize this costly water project to just fuel more suburban sprawl in the desert down there. Why, you know? And so they have put forward this proposal that, hey, you can meet the needs of these 600,000 people when you consider that a lot of farmland is going to be retired. That means a lot less water needed to irrigate alfalfa and stuff like that. And it'll be retired because it'll be that land will be converted to subdivisions, of course. You know, 50 years from now, they're also arguing, you know, people's water needs might go down because lot sizes might be a lot smaller. You know, you cram 500,000 people into Washington County's inhabitable areas. It's like, yeah, well, the lots aren't going to be half an acre anymore. They're going to be a tenth of an acre.
Right.
So they're basically saying, you know, that you know, if you build this pipeline, you'll probably have to raise the water rates to pretty high levels, and that'll reduce use. But the fact is, Washington County has an extremely high per capita use of water.
It's cheap, right?
Yeah, and they don't charge profligate users that much extra for it. So this report by Western Resource Advocates, you know, they compare, you know, water rates that St. George, rather the Washington County Water Conservancy District, imposes on St. George residents versus places like Grand Junction or Colorado Springs or Tucson. And, you know, they're comparing water bills for someone who's, you know, using 40,000 gallons a month, which is a ton of water. Yeah. And here's, you know, a St. George resident, residents would pay like less than $100. And down in Tucson, they'd be paying $600 for that amount of water. So they're showing that they're trying to argue that there's a lot of room here for Southwest Utah to improve its conservation.
We've heard this argument before from other conservation groups.
Absolutely. Nothing new.
You report that this is something that's a little bit, I mean, maybe not new, but different in that it's more of a formal, you know, proposal, a comprehensive proposal.
Yeah, let's create the context here. So
sure.
the federal government is doing an environmental review of the Lake Powell pipeline. It's 140 miles from Glen Canyon Dam to San Hollow Reservoir. It goes right across northern Arizona and southern Utah. And it would cost upwards of $2 billion, 1.8. It's like the numbers keep changing, you know. And it would move 86,000 acre-feet of water a year. So what these groups are saying is the federal agency handling this, which I can't – it keeps changing. I think it's the Bureau of Land Management now. When they conducted their environmental impact statement, they neglected to – examine an alternative in which no pipeline would be built, and you know where they would meet, you know where Washington County would meet its needs through local sources and reduce water use, and the possibility that these growth projections are inflated. You know, I mean, you think about it, like, are we really going to have 500,000 people move into St. George and surrounding communities? That does seem kind of excessive, and so what they're, you know, so what they're saying is, so they've hired a consultant whose expertise is in, you know, water demand management, and they've kind of, you know, marshaled the data in a more formal way. It's more than just what the other groups have been doing for a long time, is just making these arguments, and these are arguments that make a lot of sense. But here we are. It's like, here's the data. Here's what we've found, that if in what other communities, comparable communities in the Southwest, have accomplished by, you know, tiered water rates, you know, landscaping ordinances, things like that. There's, you know, St. George could conceivably get its per capita water use cut in half. In which case, if you cut the per capita water use in half, well, you basically double your water availability. So
what do the water managers down in St. George say about this proposal?
Yeah, I mean, one thing they point out is, like, okay, you know, Utah Rivers Council and other groups have been pushing these arguments for a long time. However, what they're saying is Washington County needs to, quote unquote, diversify its sources of water away from the Virgin River and local sources. And Utah does, you know, claim to have a large chunk of the Colorado River's flow that it has not used, and that's where this water would come from. It's quote unquote Utah's water that flows into Lake Powell and ultimately gets released down to the lower basin states of Arizona, Nevada, California. And so this, in a sense, was, you know, this, you know, there's this hidden agenda, I feel like, is going on with the Lake Powell pipeline, and that's to, you know, stake a claim to the Colorado River's water. St. George is also in the Colorado River Basin, but the lower basin. So they're taking upper basin water and moving it by pipeline to the lower basin. That sets up a whole nother set of complications, and it's opened the door for the six other Colorado River Basin states to formally oppose this project. They've sent letters to the Department of Interior saying, please do not finalize this environmental impact statement. We see there's a lot of legal questions that need to be answered first.
Including, I guess, the sort of pecking order of water rights. I mean, is it that because you're moving water from the upper basin to the lower basin, you then kind of fall back in line?
That's like this wonky part of it one that really understands.
Okay.
But it does create complicating legal factors.
What about the fact that the the Lake Powell pipeline isn't Lake Powell at its lowest point in recorded, you know, since it's been filled?
Well, in fairness to Washington County, this thing got proposed like 20 years ago. Back when Lake Powell itself was full, and now we know that Lake Powell just hit its historic low last week, and it's still bottoming out. So But the Colorado River will be there, and the Lake Powell pipeline would probably, you know, still be able to draw water out of it, even if the Lake Powell pipeline falls down to they call Deadpool.
If Lake Powell does,
If Lake Powell falls to what they call Deadpool, it's likely that they'd still be able to pull water from it, because they've looked at what's happened to Las Vegas with its reliance on Lake Mead, down the big reservoir downstream. And they kept having to move their intakes around. It costs billions of dollars. So now Las Vegas is pulling their water from the bottom of Lake Mead. And so I think, you know, the Lake Powell pipeline would be look forward to that possibility and put their intakes to draw water from the bottom of the lake.
I don't think people need reminding that climate change is projected to make conditions in the West worse, and the Colorado River Basin is expected to keep drying out, right?
I mean, that's what the projections are, yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering how that plays into all of this. I mean, how that plays into decision-making on conservation versus construction.
So climate change is being used as an argument in both sides of this case.
Okay.
So the Washington County Water District is saying, look, climate change or persistent drought is imperiling our local water sources, as it is for everybody else in the West. On the other hand, you have the environmental groups saying that climate change is reducing, you know, water supplies all over the place. This is, this effort to move water over to St. George is just, in a sense, grabbing is a water grab that's going to deprive someone else of the water.
Another question that I wonder about frequently is, the wisdom of, I guess it's about where we grow and how we grow and maybe where we shouldn't grow. Is there any, movement anywhere in the West, Brian, to put limits on the growth of a certain area that maybe doesn't have available water so that we don't, go over the cliff of, maybe we're already over the cliff.
It sure seems like we ought to be thinking that way. But the state of Utah has always said, well, it's not our job to say where growth will happen. But in a sense, by funding the Lake Powell pipeline, they're kind of picking a winner, saying growth is going to happen in St. George, and we're going to accommodate it. So as a result, Washington County is going to could potentially grow beyond its limits to sustain itself, that's a whole other question. But back to your question, are we seeing efforts to limit growth? Well, there are some moratoriums coming down in Utah in response to the drought that, certain municipalities, I'm not sure which ones, but they're announcing, restrictions on issuing new building permits, considering that water supplies are not particularly reliable right now.
Right.
Yeah. But that's a short-term thing. In terms of long-term, we're going to cap growth at a certain spot. I don't know if that's happening anywhere in Utah.
Just going back to the idea of conserving enough water down in St. George to, maybe to increase the available water supply, how hard would that kind of conservation that's being advocated for in this report that you reported on, how hard would that be? Is it, you talked about increasing prices, but are there other examples of cities that have done what this group is advocating for?
Yeah, well, Western Resource Advocates has been involved in this fight for a long time, as are these other groups. I don't want to say it's like this particular group acting alone. And what's been argued for quite some time is that if St. George could get its per capita water use in line with what other southwestern cities have accomplished, the need for the Lake Powell pipeline's water would at least be greatly reduced. And would it not be preferable from a financial standpoint to not build the pipeline if you can take steps to avoid that? That's kind of what they're saying. They're saying, look, other communities have done this. It's not that painful, but tiered water rates are a big part of that. One thing the Western Resource Advocates has highlighted is so much of Utah's water district revenues come from property taxes, which they kind of are saying, look, that amounts to kind of a subsidy of the water. And if people are paying for the water, what they pay covers the cost of developing and delivering it, they'll be inclined to use less of it. But then if it's, subsidized and they're paying low water rates as a result, which is kind of an issue in Utah, then the financial incentive to conserve isn't there. So they're saying just through putting a price signal out there, we can reduce water use. They accomplished it in other places Let's get serious with it here. Meanwhile, the state of Utah, the Water Resources Board says, "Oh, we've done fabulous
conservation.
We've reduced per capita water use by 25%, and Washington County has led the charge in that regard." Well, I don't know if that's saying a whole lot, because when you're starting with such huge amounts of per capita water use, you cut 25%. Well, you're still way above everybody else. So I don't know how meaningful that argument is.
Everybody else in the nation?
Everybody else in the Southwest. Okay. I mean, let's compare apples to apples.
Yeah.
You can't compare, Utah with somewhere in the Midwest where it rains all the time. Our water needs are greater. Let's face it. If we want to have landscaping in Utah, especially in a place like St. George, we need to use more water. But we're talking, compared to Colorado, Nevada, Arizona communities.
Just as a reminder, I know that Utah Governor Spencer Cox made headlines on this front not that long ago, but I can't remember if he was questioning this idea or not, but the amount of water that is used in the production of alfalfa in the state of Utah is significant, right? I mean, it's a massive amount of water.
It's pretty big. So agriculture uses about 80% of the water used in Utah is used by agriculture. And alfalfa is the number one agricultural product in the state. It's probably more than half in terms of value, mm-hmm. and in terms of land cultivated. It seemed to touch a nerve with Governor Cox. And maybe that's, he comes from a long line of alfalfa growers in Sanibel County. Refresh me.
Well, I can't remember exactly. It was essentially that that farmers were getting a bad rap for water use, and I don't remember the details either. I just saw the headline went by me.
Well, I think his point was is that the agricultural growers are really taking a beating, and certainly some of them are. Their water deliveries are being curtailed. They're not going to get a third or maybe even a second cutting of alfalfa this year. But I don't know if that's true of every alfalfa grower, because some have more senior rights and aren't going to get curtailed. Hmm. But those with the growers with junior rights are in trouble. There's probably no question about that.
Okay. Yeah. There's parallel stories that we could dive into. We got to take a break here in a second. But, here up north, the Great Salt Lake and the proposed Bear River diversion, again, big dreams for water infrastructure projects. And maybe not enough water. I mean, at least at the present moment, with the Great Salt Lake at its lowest point ever, to fulfill the current needs of the ecosystem. Certainly, yeah. I don't know about agricultural producers, but another topic for another story, I think, Brian. But any comments on that before we head to a break?
No.
Okay, great. Strange days, and here we are in the midst of a drought. And Brian, thanks for your coverage on this proposal from these groups. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll turn to more from this past week's news, including a story about Indian boarding schools. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. Support for UPR programming comes from our members and Stokes Nature Center Canyon Jams, presenting Highline Drifters, August 6th at 7 p.m., located at Von Bear Park in Providence. Information at logannature.org/canyonjams. Support also comes from Cafe Ibis, 52 Federal Avenue in historic downtown Logan. Open 7 days a week, featuring triple-certified coffee, triple-certified bird-friendly coffee, espresso bar, beans and brewing tools, and many gift options. Information and ordering at cafeibis.com.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brian Maffley and Zach Podmore. It is our live Friday morning Utah News Review. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK or tweeting to @KCPW. Now to Zach Podmore, who just happens to be in Salt Lake City today and on a Friday, and so we're glad to have you here in studio. Zach, U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last month announced that the agency she leads will be undertaking a review of the troubled legacy of Native American boarding schools in the United States. This week, members of an indigenous-led Utah nonprofit sent a letter to Haaland expressing an interest in getting involved in that review. And also, the letter, you know, was trying to elevate a couple of issues that might otherwise have gotten overlooked. Maybe you can just tell us who sent this letter and what it was all about.
Yes, this letter came from a nonprofit that does its work in San Juan County called Utah Dene Bakea. They're most well known for their work around Bears Ears National Monument issues, but they also do, you know, a lot of other work related to the Navajo Nation and Ute Mountain Ute communities in San Juan County and Pueblo communities elsewhere in the Four Corners. In response to this announcement from Secretary Haaland, who's the first Native American to serve in a presidential cabinet, she's a member of the Laguna Pueblo from New Mexico, Utah Dene Bakea offered to help with this review of Native American boarding schools around the Four Corners. They have 11 members on their board of directors. They're all Native Americans. And every single one of them attended boarding schools as children. So this letter is mostly just a summary of some of the experiences that this, you know, board of directors of the nonprofit had at these schools.
Maybe we need a primer on what boarding schools were, Zach. I mean, why did they exist? What did they do?
Yeah, well, thank you. That's a better place to start. So the federal government ran Native American boarding school programs throughout the country for 150 years, starting in the early 1800s and up through the 1960s and 70s. Hundreds of thousands of Native American children were sent to these schools, forced to go to these schools without, you know, whether or not their parents consented to this. And there, they, you know, weren't allowed to speak their native languages. They were, you know, mostly taught by non-indigenous teachers, and, you know, a lot of the traditions weren't passed down and actually, you know, explicitly forbidden. And that was kind of the purpose of these schools, was forced assimilation, or as others have, you know, referred to it, a tactic of genocide, of trying to repress these traditions and cultures and languages that, you know, have been on this continent for thousands of years. So the review that Secretary Haaland initiated is just to try to better understand what federal policies were in place that, you know, that kind of shaped this system and what impacts they had on communities.
How long did they operate from, you know, at what point did they begin and how long did they run until, if that's a question you can answer?
The first federal schools, as far as I know, were started in around 1820, and they ran for 150 years. So,
And quite a few stories of abuse in these schools. I mean, you talked about the forced assimilation and the idea of erasure of cultures. There was a federally run school up in Brigham City, the Intermountain Indian School. Can you talk about that very much? That was just one of the locations in Utah, or was it the only location in Utah?
So the letter from Utah Dene Bakea lists 20 schools around the Four Corners that these 11 board members attended. So this was a big network of schools. Some were privately run, some were run by maybe states or counties. Maybe some were, you know, religious schools, and the majority of them were federally run. Intermountain Boarding School Intermountain Indian Boarding School, as it was called in Brigham City, was the largest boarding school for members of the Navajo Nation, as far as I understand from this letter. So, yeah.
Woody Lee, who's the executive director of Utah Dene Bakea, in this letter, he asked Secretary Haaland to expand the review beyond the federally run facilities like the one we were just describing. Can you explain that request? What was he asking them to do to sort of go beyond just the schools themselves to look at other sort of placement programs that were out there?
Yeah, so the Department of Interior oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which, you know, ran these schools. So the review is kind of focused on, you know, the federal programs that were in place that, you know, were the majority, where the majority of Native Americans students were sent as part of these programs. But as I just mentioned, there were many other schools that weren't federally run and also foster care programs that, you know, had similar impacts in terms of separating children from their parents and their traditions. So, yeah, Woody Lee, the executive director of UDB, is asking that as part of this review, the Interior Department, you know, not just focus on federally run boarding schools, but also look at some of these other schools that were kind of part of the same system. The biggest one being in Utah, the LDS Indian Placement Program, which took 50,000 Native American children from the 1940s up until the year 2000 into LDS households as part of a kind of a foster care program. So this is different than boarding schools. It's but it is something that UDB is requesting, you know, this federal review look at as well.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that ran that placement program has been sued by some former participants in this program because of allegations of abuse, including sexual abuse. Is that lawsuit ongoing, or is it, you know, do you know much about that?
Yeah, that's just a small part of the story. I don't know. I'm definitely not an expert on that by any means. There are. But I know there was, you know, quite a number of lawsuits over the last 10 years from former participants in this program, both in Navajo Nation court and in federal court. I don't know the details of how each of those cases played out, but this is, you know, something that was a pattern of in the legal system over the last 10 years.
The letter from Utah Dene Bekea to Interior includes this litany of pretty terrible experiences relating to these schools and also to those placements, you know, abductions, again, sexual exploitation, physical and psychological abuse. And then this letter also expresses a concerted desire to understand how all of this happened. There's a reference to a U.S. senator from Utah, Senator Albert Watkins, and harmful policies that he put in place towards indigenous people, descriptions of regular citizens kind of being deputized to police Native people in Blanding, for example. Yeah, and it's filled with a history of racism. And I don't know what to ask you here. You know, maybe on that front, Zach, there's this history of church doctrine that a belief from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that kind of looms large in the background. Can you talk about that? I don't know. I mean, it's a description from the Book of Mormon of how the Native people were thought of, I guess, at the time, and that is doctrine that I think has kind of been edited, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So as late as 1976, this, you know, Indian foster program through the LDS Church was referred to as, you know, sometimes as the Lamanite program, which is, you know, referring to a group of people in the Book of Mormon that are thought to be the ancestors of modern day Native American people. This is something that's, you know, it's a really complicated story. And this, as you say, this letter is just really pointing to how widespread these experiences were among Native American people born in San Juan County before the year 1970, as, you know, the vast majority of people attended these schools or foster programs. And there's just a lot of questions of people who went through these experiences. They don't even they might not even know, you know, who ran the school they attended,
right.
What, you know, institution or government was funding it, how these policies came into being. So I think the kind of thrust of this whole effort is to try to get more understanding of what occurred, how it occurred, why it occurred, and then to hopefully get some closure and accountability for all these issues.
You know, it's amazing, Zach, that, you know, the government would take steps like this, separating children from their families, but yet there's so little accountability and so little known about this program. There seems to be a lot to unearth here.
And so this letter is sent to Secretary Holland from Interior. What does she, you know, what does she do with it? The idea is to incorporate, or they want to, you know, participate in this, and they are, again, as you said, looking for funding sources. They want to understand school operators, the tangential businesses and beneficiaries for the facilities that were operated, and they have a wealth of people that they're offering as sort of sources for the Interior Department. Do we know what Interior might do with that?
I don't think Interior's responded to this letter as far as I know, but yeah, they're offering a wealth of resources on the ground in San Juan County of people who went through these boarding school systems, and then also just the local histories, government records, all that stuff. Utah Dene Baquet is offering to be, a resource to this federal government review and trying to gather a lot of this information, find people to interview, find the records both on the Navajo Nation and maybe in the city of Blanding, the county, San Juan County offices that might shed some light on some of these issues. So we're very at the beginning stages of this whole review process, and this is really just an opening offer to be a part of that.
Is there a sort of deadline on when the review might be done?
Interior said, or Secretary Holland said, she would like it completed by April.
April of next year. Okay.
Yeah.
Zach, it's really fascinating reporting, and thank you for it. I'll direct listeners to check it out at sltrib.com. Is there anything else you want to add on this story before we head on to other news from Brian Maffley?
No, I think that covers it.
Okay. A reminder that you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. You can call 801-355-8255 to join this conversation. Pretty soon, actually relatively soon, we're going to have to turn to a recorded segment on Utahns competing in the Tokyo Olympics. But Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley, you wrote a story that on its face has to do with the oil and gas industry in Utah, a well-established industry here. But your story is also about the world of cryptocurrency and mining of a different kind. The jumping-off point here is that natural gas was going to waste. The old method of dealing with that problem was essentially to burn it, to flare it. Can you describe that?
Yeah.
And then what the solution that is being presented is now?
Well, there's just it's not just Utah. It's all over the West. There's a lot of natural gas that is produced along with oil production. And when those operators are, when they're targeting oil, they might not have the pipelines available, or the infrastructure for capturing that and getting it to market. And that's the case through no fault of their own, I might add. The oil field operator down by Moab, they're called Wesco Operating. They're a subsidiary of Kirkwood. And they own an oil field down there they acquired from Fidelity a few years ago. And we've written a lot about it because it's in a very popular recreation area outside Moab, basically the doorstep of Dead Horse and Canyonlands. So they had this problem with a natural gas, major pipeline getting shut down because basically it wasn't run properly. And that was the pipeline they needed to get their gas to an interstate line. So they had to burn it for just flaring it right at this natural gas processing facility that had been built maybe 2013, 2014.
In 2013 right. or 2014. And so instead of burning it now, instead of flaring it, they've got an answer. And yeah, I'm sorry to have to speed you up because we're running low on time. But
sure.
What,
well, the answer is to buy a bunch of equipment to burn this natural gas in generators, make electricity, and then use that electricity to power mobile data centers that were brought on site to process cryptocurrency transactions. That's how Wesco is now utilizing this resource, and it's pretty novel.
To create cryptocurrency.
Well, it's to process the cryptocurrency transactions. Yeah.
Okay.
So does cryptocurrency even exist, Roger?
These are philosophical questions that I can't answer, Brian. Yeah. There are some environmental questions about, I know, the cryptocurrency market in general. I think central to that is the idea of increased power usage for the servers that are required for the whole blockchain concept. Where does this project fall into that? Do you know?
Well, there's other oil fields where there's natural gas being wasted, where they've set up these blockchain equipment, and it is being billed as a responsible alternative to flaring it. I think a better option would just to be to figure out how to capture it. But it kind of speaks to the enormous power needs of cryptocurrency mining, quote unquote. Apparently, processing these transactions requires an enormous amount of electricity. Zach was just talking about how cryptocurrency transactions consume more power than the whole country of Argentina. Is that something?
It's amazing. Yeah. I'm sorry to have to cut us short on this, and I will direct listeners also to Brian's story at SLTrip.com, a really interesting story about sort of adaptation in the strange world that we live in. Yeah. Listeners, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will have our underplayed stories of the week and then a segment on Utahns in the Olympic Games. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Next time on LA Theater Works, actress Charlene Woodard stars in her acclaimed one-woman show chronicling her early days as a starving young actor.
A Checker cab carried me over the Triborough Bridge. Oh, please, God, make this city work for me.
In Real Life by Charlene Woodard. Next time on LA Theater Works.
Friday night at 9 here on Utah Public Radio.
This Week in This American Life. A while back, John and his wife got this kind of unusual Christmas card from their neighbor Daniel.
From all of us at Slate Ridge, we wanted to wish you two miserable souls a wonderful holiday season. People hate you two inbreds. Please feel free to move away, because no one likes alcoholics.
But actually, compared to what happened next, that didn't seem so bad. This Week.
Saturday morning at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW and joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Mavely and Zach Podmore. And to save time for a recorded segment about Utah athletes competing in the Summer Games in Tokyo, we will turn now to our picks for underplayed stories of the week. And Zach Podmore, do you want to kick us off with a pick for a story or a topic that we didn't cover on the show today?
Sure. Yeah, I just wanted to let listeners know that the Tribune has hired a new Southern Utah reporter. Is Alistair Bitsoy. He's a member of the Navajo Nation. He formerly worked for the Navajo Times and has done communications work, and are really excited to have him on board. So he's in Cedar City this week covering the flooding there. You can check out some of his first stories from that. But I think we can expect a lot of great work from him coming forward. So stay tuned to sltrib.com from some of his reporting.
Excellent. Thanks for that pick. Brian Mavely, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Yeah, so last week, two of Utah's most iconic bodies of water, the Great Salt Lake and Lake Powell, hit their lowest levels on record, happening at the same time. I think that's a sign of the times right now, that our water availability is under serious pressure.
It's a good pick for Underplayed Story, and I'm going to forego mine in the interest of time, but I will say Zach Podmore, Brian Mavely, thank you both for being here today.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah. With that, we will now turn to my conversation with Julie Jagg about Utah Olympians. Salt Lake Tribune Olympics and Enterprise reporter Julie Jagg, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. We've got a number of Utah Olympians competing in the Summer Games, the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. It's funny that
2020 and 2021.
Yeah, it's confusing. Yeah. And you've been tracking their performance through the 2+ weeks that the Olympics are happening. It's hard to know where to start because your coverage goes everywhere. You've got swimming, you've got climbing, skateboarding, mountain biking. But I think that maybe the most obvious place to begin is the story of former University of Utah gymnast Michaela Skinner. Can you kind of give us the background on her Olympic dreams? I mean, she was somebody who was kind of done with her career and then decided to have a go at it again, I guess. Can you give us that
right.
background?
Yeah. So she had tried for the Olympics in 2016 and had finished fourth in the all-around and was pretty sure that that was going to be good enough to get her on the four. I think at that time it was a five-person team. And, you know, it's up to a selection committee if you don't finish in the top two. And so she was selected as an alternate. So it's a hard place to be an alternate. And I really admire the ones that are because you get to go to the Olympics, but you don't really get to be an Olympian. You train separately. Yeah. I think in Tokyo, even like the alternates like had to – they rode in the back of the bus and they stayed in different rooms. And, you know, it's just – they ate at different tables. They're just not – you're there, but you're not really there. So it was a really hard, I think, experience for her to be that close and to feel like she'd made it and not get to go. So, you know, when she came back to Utah and then was working out, I think she really felt like that was something like she wanted to actually get to compete, like to see if she could still actually compete at that level.
And she got to. I mean, she
yeah.
right. So this year, she didn't go to the Olympics as an alternate.
Right.
But
well, yeah, not an alternate. She was an individual, which is not exactly what she wanted either. And that's a weird rule for this particular Olympics where they took two individual competitors as well as the four-person team. Just was a gymnastics federation rule.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then this is just central to the story, is the fact that her Olympics appeared to be, I mean, her Olympics basically came to an end earlier this week, except for that maybe in reality they didn't come to an end. Can you explain this to
us? Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, I think a lot of us are holding out hope. We're like, oh, she's going to, it's like this comeback story where she gets, put me in coach, I'm ready. So what happened is that in the qualifications, which is kind of where everything is determined at the Olympics, you have to finish, I think it's top eight. I don't remember exactly among scores, but then you also have to finish. There's two per country rule. So she'd have to finish among the top two among the United States competitors. And that's really tough when you've got Simone Biles because that means basically you have to finish one. You know, you have to finish right below her.
Right.
And she did great. She had a great qualifications, but Jade Carey really stepped it up, and Jade Carey took that spot in Michaela's two best. They have the same two best events, and that's floor and vault. And so Jade Carey took those spots.
Shoot. And so that was basically the end of Michaela Skinner's Olympics, except for that it wasn't because of the Simone Biles story. For somebody who's been living under a rock, maybe you can remind us what happened there.
Right. Yeah. So Michaela had given a little wave. She was done. She was in tears. And then what happened is when they did the team event, the team final, Simone Biles went out and did her vault. She did her first vault and it didn't go well. It didn't go right. She didn't do the twist she was supposed to do. And shortly after that, she conferred with some medics and then she announced that she was going to step away from the stretch from the rest of the event. She wasn't going to do the floor, the vault, the beam, or the bars. And then later at the press conference later, she said that she didn't have technically an injury, but it was mental issues that she was dealing with.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, this story has been told a million times, and I think people are aware of this. Is it that Biles won't compete in just some events, or is it that she won't compete in all events going forward? And is that sort of a question mark that matters for the story of Michaela Skinner here?
It does matter. So we don't know yet. She scratched, obviously, out of the all-around event, and so that opened the door for Jade Carey to get to compete, and obviously Suni Lee won that event, which is pretty exciting. But so she could do all four of the apparatus, or she could scratch from all four of the apparatus. And the way it affects Michaela is that Michaela had a high enough score. She finished fourth altogether of all the people doing the vault in the qualifications, but was third among the Americans. So she can't, you know, she couldn't move on. But if Simone scratches from that event, then Michaela will be able to compete. And what's kind of interesting about that is that any of the other events that Simone scratches from, the Americans didn't score high enough to be able to compete. So any, if she scratches from any of the other ones, there won't be an American won't be the one that's taking her place. It'll be someone from another country.
Okay. And as of right now, I mean, we're recording on Thursday, so it's a little confusing. This is for Saturday's vault final. We don't know whether or not Michaela Skinner will be there.
It's actually Sunday morning.
Oh, Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, super early Sunday morning, 2:45, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, so we don't know. So and we probably won't know until probably Saturday night.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
It's fascinating stuff. You know, we've been talking about a former University of Utah gymnast, Michaela Skinner. Maybe we can now turn to a future U of U gymnast, Grace McCallum. She is going to arrive at the University of Utah already having an Olympic medal. What did she medal in, Julie?
So she medaled in the team event. So that was the one that happened Wednesday night, or I guess it was early Thursday morning. Yeah. My days get all mixed up.
Hey, well, you probably stay up late watching the Olympics.
I do. I've been staying up late and up early. It's been interesting. Yeah, so she did great. She really stepped up. The team was shaken, obviously, when Simone went out. But they found it within themselves to just keep going forward and do their best and kind of come over that. And so, yeah, so she ended up with a silver medal.
Wow.
So pretty exciting that she's expected to come to the University of Utah. Sometimes after athletes go to the Olympics, they decide to just keep training. And with Paris just 3 years away, it's possible that she will put off school until then. Hmm. It's not known, but she has committed.
Okay. There is a former University of Utah gymnast, one who is committed to the University of Utah but may or may not compete.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also Kara Eaker, a University of Utah gymnast who was slated to compete or was slated to be there at the Olympics, but in the end didn't even get a chance. What happened there, Julie?
Yeah, so she was an alternate. So the chances, of, like Michaela before, the chances of her actually getting to compete were pretty rare, especially with the two individuals on the team that could step into that team spot.
Yeah.
But she traveled with the team to Tokyo, but when they arrived, they do COVID testing, and she unfortunately tested positive for COVID. She didn't have any symptoms, wasn't feeling badly. But was put into quarantine, and as well as her roommate, and then they eventually, I think she ended up coming home because
right.
She couldn't compete. But no one else on the team got it, thank goodness.
Thank goodness indeed. You know, we're talking about one athlete who ended up testing positive for COVID. There's another story that is similar to that, and it is. It has to do with beach volleyball's oldest ever Olympian, and this is a Utah native from Bountiful named Jake Gibb. He's 45 years old. Beach volleyball, though, is a game that is played by two people, and his teammate tested positive for COVID, right?
Right, yeah. I think he always takes exception to being considered the oldest, but he is, so, you know, we can call him that. Yeah, it was actually a terrible turn of two events, so Kara Eaker tested positive. She was the first non-competing mm-hmm. athlete in Tokyo to test positive. And then Taylor Crabb, who was Jake Gibb's partner for the last 5 years, arrived in Tokyo, and he became the first American athlete to test positive for COVID. So when he arrived in Tokyo, that's when that happened. So Jake had to get another partner. We thought he might be done. We thought, well,
How do you play without your partner? You can't
right.
play.
Yeah, you can't play with one person. You know, you have to pass to somebody. They had guidelines set up to have an alternate, and so they called in Tri Bourne, who Jake had never played with before. And Tri came, they called him up. I guess Tri was on his way back from a vacation and said, come to Tokyo, and so he did,
They're doing well, right?
Yeah, they're doing great. But, you know, what's even crazier is so he arrives, and then 36 hours later, Jake Gibb has to go into isolation because of a close contact with COVID, which I think was probably with Taylor Crabb. And so, you know, they haven't gotten to spend any time together. You know, they were hoping to bond a little bit in the hotel room or Olympic Village room, whatever it is. And no, they didn't get any of that time. But they're doing great. You know, they're set to make it into the playoffs without any problem.
Wow. Despite having spent any time together or bonding, I think it's interesting. It kind of runs counter to the idea that, you know, you should have everybody living together and necessarily becoming close that, well, I don't know what's right for.
Well, yeah, I mean, beach volleyball, so I used to play a little bit of beach volleyball, and it's a lot about, you know, how well you vibe with your partner and just communication, right? And just how you can bring your partner up or down depending on your own mood. And so, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. It's just one other person you're relying on.
Huh.
So I think it's pretty impressive that they have been able to do as well as they have.
Very cool. You know, there's no way we're going to be able to get through all of the Utah Olympian stories, and we're actually running low on time, and so I'm going to direct people to your coverage. But, Julie Jack, I'm wondering if there are, you know, other narratives that have really stuck out to you from the games. Anything you want to highlight?
There's so much going on. We'll look forward a little bit. I mean, mountain biking was great. Haley Batten totally charged back in that event. But I think we'd be remiss to not mention Ryan White, who is the first Utahn to go to the Olympics in swimming, and she is now favored to win a medal, if not the gold medal, which is pretty crazy. I have a story in Thursday's paper about her and just, you know, what are the roadblocks to someone becoming a Olympian from Utah in swimming, and just the focus that she had from, who knows, like 9 years old or maybe younger. You know, you have a kid say, oh, I'm going to be Olympian. And you're kind of like, yeah, sure you are. But this one, she really meant it.
She really meant it. Does she have a specific event that she's expected to medal in? I mean, is that the...
Yes. So she took fourth in the 400 backstroke. Backstroke's her event. And the 200 backstroke is the one coming up. Friday night's the final. And she is right now doing pretty well. She's expected to medal in that one. She won the U.S. trials.
All right, well, go Ryan White. And how about one more, Julie? One other story that you've been following of Utahns in the Olympics.
Okay. There are so many stories out there. I do think the climbers we should mention just because it's the first time in that sport. And we have Nathaniel Coleman, who's a native here in Utah. And, I mean, just all the attention that the Olympics has brought to that sport, I think, has been a little bit overwhelming for the sport and for the competitors. But it's going to be really exciting to watch them, and I think it's something that we'll be wanting to watch for a long time. And I think climbing gyms are going to get really busy.
Busier than they already are.
Yes.
That's maybe a sad aftermath of the Olympics.
Just like your skate parks. They're also going to get busier.
Right. And actually, maybe just we can end there really quickly. You did a little profile on the fact that there are some events that are happening here in Salt Lake City in the not-too-distant future that are skateboarding events. Skateboarding is another one at the Olympics that's new this year. Can you give us a little profile or a little preview of what's happening? I know there's a Utah tie-in in the fact that some future events are going to happen here.
Right, yeah. So skateboarding competition is coming to the Utah State Fair Park, and it's the Street League Skateboarding, which is, it's kind of like your, if you want to make the analogy, NBA, your pro league of street skateboarding, which was the one that went early in the Olympics. And the biggest names that were in that are going to be there, and I'm super excited to see these 13-year-old girls who were just ripping it. Reisa Leal and the two medalists from Japan, and then the one that really stole my heart was a Rus. I'm not even going to try to mention her, say her last name, but
the Brazilian.
No, she's from the Netherlands, yeah, I just thought she was really awesome out there. So I'm ready for the girls to see the girls out there, and then Nyjah Houston and all the big name of the guys are going to be there too.
That's later this year.
Yes, so that is August, end of August, August 26th, 7th.
Very cool. Julie Jagg is Olympics and Enterprise reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. I really appreciate your coverage on the Olympics. It's been fun to read and stay up to date on what's happening with our Olympic athletes. So thanks for doing it. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. So much fun.
Yeah. And that's all the time we have for on the show today. Thanks again for listening.
Utah Public Radio is supported by our members and Cash Theater Company, presenting Monty Python's Spamalot, a new musical lovingly ripped off from the classic film comedy Monty Python and the Holy Grail, showing at the Ellen Eccles Theater August 13th through August 21st. Tickets available at cashtheater.com.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM Logan. Also heard online at upr.org.